Trying to understand why someone kills is probably why we are all here today. Quoting the Boomtown Rats from 1979, "And Daddy doesn't understand it. He always said she was good as gold. And he can see no reasons, because there are no reasons. What reasons do you need to be shown?" This is the case of Charlie Brandt, and this is Murder Me on Monday.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the Murder Me on Monday podcast. I'm Cameron, and joined with me is Mother.
Hello. If you'd like to support us via patreon.com, where you can get early access and exclusive content and stickers should you want them, please do consider it. But leaving a review helps, and a huge thank you to those that have done that, and a new episode is live on Patreon. We are not picking on you, Florida, as this is where we end up, but it's not where it starts. That opening was from the song Don't Like Mondays, about the shooting spree of 16-year-old Brenda Ann Spencer, who fired at a primary school playground in San Diego on the 29th of January 1979. She killed two adults and injured eight children and one police officer. Brenda's only explanation was, "I don't like Mondays. This livens up the day." Apparently, Sir Bob wrote that song in a couple of hours. They were due to play a corporate gig for Apple and Steve Jobs. And there's some digs about machines and tech and all that in the song as well. So. It's rather apt too, because Charlie's family didn't understand what he did either. And they hid it away for many years, and they're still hiding it today. But let us start at the beginning. We know nothing about their background, but Ilse and Herbert Brandt arrived in Texas in 1955 from post-World War II Germany, hoping to start a new life away from the aftermath of the war. They moved frequently all over the place, Texas, Illinois, Connecticut, to name a few, all the while trying to settle. But it's mainly due to Herbert's job, and they moved so much. I think they were 24 and 23 at the time when they landed in the US or thereabouts. They swiftly had one child, a girl called Angela, followed shortly afterwards on the 23rd of February 1957 by a boy they called Carl Eric, but he was known as Charlie.
You can tell who the bad guy is going to be because he gets a date when he's born.
Yes.
One of them was, they had a daughter and then they had another one who was born in 1957. You go, okay, it was him. When you sent me this sort of crib note thing that I read so I kind of have some idea of what's going on, some kind of names, etc., I read it and I'm like, okay, that's not what I expected, but okay. It kind of picks up again. There's a peak and a trough, and then another peak, and I didn't expect that.
Yeah, regular listeners will know what we do is we don't start with the blast opener of the main crime. We do it in chronological order, purely and simply because
it's partly easier to follow.
Yeah. I find it difficult.
Rather than find with the conclusion and then work your way back.
And then people bounce backwards and forwards in the timeline, which...
Because it's chronological, you can kind of follow it. If you're confused on one bit, you can kind of go back to the start and listen to it again in the order that it happens, rather than be like, oh, he kills everyone. I'm done with the podcast, I guess.
So Herbert was a trier. He worked on a production line but went to night school. He really did live the American dream, working and studying hard, first to become a draftsman and then became a project engineer. It must have been really, really hard for them. Let's briefly talk about the war and what happened to people who were not considered part of the Allies' pact. Internment of Japanese Americans during the Second World War is fairly widely known and well documented. However, less is known about the thousands of what's called ethnic Germans who were also detained, as well as a smaller number of Italians and Italian Americans. We did the same here in the UK. I'll point that out. It's not, I'm picking on America for this. The precedent was set during the First World War when laws dating back to the 18th century were used to authorise the detention of anyone considered to be an enemy alien and therefore a possible threat to security in the war effort. When you listen to Sting singing about "I'm an illegal alien living in New York," that's what he's referring to, not Martians. So the government, or the US government, set up four camps. The main ones were located in Hot Springs, California.
Wasn't sort of the war to begin with because someone was setting up camps that they shouldn't have been?
No, that was a shooting about and
Are you having a stroke? What happening? I'm saying Hitler started gassing people in camps, and now they're going, you're an ethnic German, so we're going to start putting you in camps.
He invaded Poland. The First World War started.
No, I know, but you know what I mean. Yeah. There's clear lines to be drawn.
Yeah. So the another one was in Georgia, and these camps were referred to as Department of Justice camps, So those in turn included not only German nationals, but those of recent German descent. So think your parents were German, and you've been born here, or rather there in the US, you'd have been locked up as well. And they were now to be considered enemy aliens. Many had their homes and property seized by the government. And Cameron's looking at me like, what the hell?
Don't say I'm doing things I'm not. I'm drinking juice.
In the cases where both parents were ethnic Germans, children could end up in orphanages while their parents were in detention. And even those who were not detained still faced a really difficult situation. Their movement could be restricted and they were subjected to curfews. So after Germany surrendered, many of the internees were released and a lot of them were sent back to Germany. Others remained in the camps. And it was not until 1948 that the last enemy alien was released, 3 years after the war had ended. So none of these internees were ever found guilty of any crime or proven to be a threat to national security. It was just panic, wasn't it? So those who were released back to their homes were obliged to sign a secrecy agreement regarding the time that they spent in the camp. And they were also under threat of being returned to Germany if they breached the terms of the agreement. Staff who worked at the camps also had to agree to the secrecy. So Hermann and Ilse emigrated only 7 years after this had all been stopped. And it had to have been really hard for them to integrate, hadn't it, if you think about this. But the family loved to holiday in Florida frequently and they loved it. And they were big on the outdoor life with hunting and fishing and all that. Herbert and Ilse go on to have two more children in the late 1960s and were not done, as number five was due in February of 1971. Charlie was 13 at this point, described as quiet and perfectly ordinary. One interesting thing happened over that winter of 70-71. Hermann and Charlie had gone hunting, perfectly normal for them. Apparently, Hermann had shot Charlie's dog. The dog was a family Christmas gift the year before. It wouldn't come when Charlie's dad called for it. So what had actually happened, they were on holiday in Florida and then Herbert took Charlie hunting and the dog ran away. They spotted it the next day and Herbert became angry when it wouldn't come when he called it. When the dog went into some bushes and wouldn't come out, Herbert shot it. He said he wanted to scare the dog out, not to kill it, but the dog was dead. And Charlie was stunned. Funnily enough, there's mention in some papers that he actually shot the dog twice, deliberately or not wanting to pay the vet bills or what. Yet Charlie and he didn't discuss it in all the time. They just carried on hunting for the remainder of that afternoon. As per everything with this family, as you will get to recognise, nothing is discussed. It's just silence. Now, this little incident about the dog shooting is missing from lots of reports on this case. 3rd of January 1971, the family had just returned home to Fort Wayne, Indiana, after this Christmas holiday in Florida. It was school the next day, so Angela was in bed reading, Ilse was in the bath, and Herbert was having a shave. Charlie snuck into his parents' room and took his father's 9mm handgun from the bedside table. He tucked it into the top of his trousers and returned to the dining room table, supposedly to finish his homework. Herbert was chatting to Ilse and he was shaving and he saw Charlie enter the room from the corner of his eye as his back was actually turned to the door. Three shots into Herbert's back and he crashed to the floor, injured but not dead. Ilse starts screaming. She starts screaming at Charlie to stop and for Angela to call the police. Charlie turned and shot her twice, killing her and her unborn son with one shot directly hitting the baby. Deliberate aim? Possibly. The main reports say that Charlie then burst into Angela's room and took aim at her with the gun misfiring and she escaped. The police reports say that Charlie went into Angela's room waving the gun about and threw it on the floor. And Angela kicked it under the bed. They got into a struggle, possibly Charlie trying to get the gun back. Angela told Charlie she loved him and she hugged him. And they turned on the TV in the living room. She tells him they could run away and go and live in a hippie commune. It was the 1970s, wasn't it? It's all the rage. And he should go and get their younger sisters from their beds and Angela would wait for him. He walks backwards out of the room, watching her and saying, "Don't leave me." And Angela was assuring him that she wouldn't.
Who is this reporting? This is in the
police reports. This is what the police said afterwards actually happened.
So was the first one his account of the gun misfiring and her running away, or was that her account?
That's just newspaper reports.
Okay, so it's just misreported.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was halfway up the stairs, walking, you know, going backwards, when Angela bolted, yelling her head off. Yet again, two versions of what happens next. One is she ran to the neighbours for help and was covered in blood. The other was that she ran to the neighbours who were slowly answering the door. So she ran to another house. And by the time the first neighbour got to the door, Charlie stood there telling them that he'd shot his parents and could they please call the police. In the meantime, Herbert had managed to lift himself up to pull the plug in the bath in the hope that his wife would not drown. He wouldn't know if her wounds were fatal if she was already dead. And he managed to get himself to his bedroom where he locked the door and called the police. Obviously, it's chaos. And when Charlie is questioned by the police, you know, when did you pick the gun up in your father's room? Did you intend to use it? He said, "I didn't really want to. It was like I was sort of programmed to do it. I hesitated, but the next thing I knew, I'd shot them."
Is that some kind of sleeper agent? What does he mean? He's programmed to do it.
Exactly.
Maybe some weird teenage hormone thing? Being driven by it?
It don't get any better. The police say, "Did you get any enjoyment when you shot your parents?" And he said, "No, I didn't want to. That's the thing, because I loved my parents. We were happy." Police asked, "If your sister would have gotten in your way that night, do you think you would have killed her?" He replied, "It's hard to say. Probably anybody." He was later taken to see his father in hospital. Charlie asked him for permission to cry. That's rather telling, isn't it? He apologised to his dad more than once for the shooting. And Herbert reassured Charlie that everything would be all right and he would visit him wherever Charlie was sent. Charlie also mentioned the family dog. And his father said he was sorry.
So the dad said he'll follow Charlie wherever he goes.
Yeah.
So he's not blaming his son?
No.
Why? Because he shot your wife, your unborn child, and kind of attempted to kill...
I don't know what's in his
head. Younger sister. I don't understand why that's happening.
Oh, it doesn't get any better. So Ilse was an only child. She was cremated and her ashes were spread in Florida. Charlie attended her funeral in leg shackles. Less than a week after the shooting, two or three experts, depending on where you read, determined that Charlie had no mental disabilities. One of these experts told a judge that Charlie should not be placed in jail or a hospital. Another one said that Charlie acted on an irresistible impulse and had a moral, not mental, defect. They called it an adjustment reaction of adolescence. And they said it was a response to a stressful situation that usually lasts no more than 6 months.
It doesn't excuse the fact you killed someone. Yeah. What they said is, "Oh, bro, he was a bit stressed. That's why he did it." And personal responsibility, he did that.
But he was only 13. As you say, what stressful situation? His father killing his dog, his mother about to give birth to another sibling, school maybe. He did mention school at one point, saying it was a combination of things why he did it. But what? It's never made clear, or if it's in the paperwork, it's never been released. So these experts could find no evidence of any mental illness. But as he was 13, it's highly unlikely they would have actually said if he had one. Now they wouldn't diagnose him anyway until he's 18. So Herbert was hospitalised for about a month. Three bullets in your back would do that for you. Grand jury would determine that Charlie was not criminally responsible for his actions, but it cautioned that he might repeat them if he did not receive psychiatric treatment. Charlie had already spent 4 months in jail. He would then spend an additional year at a state mental health hospital in Indianapolis. Just as he'd made visits to Charlie in jail, Herbert drove 400 miles, two round trips to Indianapolis each weekend to bring Charlie home for visits when he was allowed them. As soon as his son was released from the hospital in June 1972, Herbert took a year's leave of absence from his job and moved his children to Ormond Beach in Florida, where the family had spent its happiest times. Now, there's no mention whether he carted those two young children. I think there were three and one at the time, and Angela up and down every time he saw Charlie, but... So Angela cried for days. She went from A's and B's and an honour roll student to D's and F's. She would quit school at age 16 to take care of her sisters, but she did later manage to get her GED. So after his hospital stay, Charlie seemed more outgoing, social, relaxed. But he told Angela that he couldn't remember what had actually happened on that fateful day. Herbert remarried and moved back to Fort Wayne to his job with his youngest children. But he left Angela and Charlie in Florida. And their German grandparents came over to care for Charlie, who was 16. Angela was 18 by that point and she'd moved out on her own. After graduating in 1974 and earning a two-year degree from a community college, Charlie became an electronics technician, a radar specialist. Angela had a child in 1979 and would not have Charlie under the same roof as her and that child. She eventually sort of settled down. She married somebody eventually, but initially he's called a partner called Joe. Stays good friends with Charlie after his and Angela's relationship ends. By April 1985, Charlie was working at the Ford Aerospace and Communications Service in Astor near Daytona Beach, where he meets Teresa Helfrich, known as Terry, on a blind date. She was a year younger than him. He wants to marry her. And he speaks to Angela, asking if he should tell Terry what he did when he was 13. According to Angela, she told him yes. He had to tell her. If she finds out later, it won't go well. If she rejects him, he'd just have to live with it. Charlie said he would tell her. Angela didn't ask Terry if he had told her. And later, Terry's family are adamant that she would never have married him if she'd known. But the suspicions that Terry knew something was off about Charlie much later. But I'll get to that.
That was a whole, Carl said he will tell Terry. Carl didn't tell Terry.
Yeah.
Kind of in the narrator voice, isn't it?
Yeah. I think she just knew he wasn't right.
I don't, Terry, you mean?
Yeah. I don't. But maybe she did know. That comes, I'll get to that. So Charlie and Terry marry on the 29th of August, 1986. Charlie was 29 and Terry was 28. All the reports say the same thing. There was no family present, and leave that statement hanging. There's no mention if Charlie or Terry eloped or just wanted a completely private do. They go on to build a 1,000-foot square home on Big Pine Key in Florida. Charlie and Terry like to travel. They spent a lot of time on boats and they fished together and even made each other's lunches. They did everything together. Now, Terry kept a journal or a diary. Well, entries from a few years after the wedding in 1993 are perfectly normal on face value, to a point. Charlie's a little depressed. Charlie started to talk things out. Talkative time, a bit emotional. Charlie called very emotional. Charlie had a rough day. Charlie, weird talk, not a good night. None of it's expanded on.
Is this the stuff that's mentioned in Terry's diary?
Yeah, that's how Terry wrote it down.
It's just bullet points.
Yeah.
The way you're writing that is as if it would be like an illiterate child.
It's not a thing now, but when I was young, it was a thing. Everybody had diaries. And
it's kind of come back round again where psychologists recommend you do that because you can look back and read happy stuff you've done.
Yeah, but you've always got I will never forget this day. And you look back on it 2 years later and you can't even remember, let alone 10, 15, 20 years later. So at some point, and it's not really clear when, Herbert moves back to Florida, probably retired. Charlie's stepmother dies in 2001. His two younger sisters live nearby. At no point have these women been told the truth about how their mother died in 1971. They have always believed that she died in a car accident. They'd initially been told, I think, or perhaps they concocted that story themselves, and no one, their father, their older sister, no one put them straight. And they don't put them straight after their stepmother dies either. September 2004. Various hurricanes were heading towards the Florida Keys. It's hurricane season, perfectly normal. But one called Ivan was expected to be bad, and residents were being told to leave. Charlie didn't want to leave. He'd boarded his house up to perfection. It's later said all the shutters and panelling over the doors and windows looked custom made. He was that meticulous. But Terry was worried and persuaded him to leave and head up the coast to Orlando, which is about 360 miles north, and stay with Terry's niece, a lady called Michelle Jones. Michelle was 37. She was unmarried and had done very well for herself. She's described variously as either an advertising executive, a middle manager, or even a marketing manager, but she worked for the Golf Channel, and how very Floridian, a TV channel for golf. She lived in a four-bedroomed house with a pool and a jacuzzi in a place called Maitland, which is just sort of north of Orlando. Small, exclusive place, apparently. Charlie and Terry arrived at Michelle's house on Saturday, September the 11th. On Sunday, Charlie called his dad about noon and said he and Terry were in Orlando and would like to come by, and they arrived about 2 p.m. They stayed for a couple of hours and then head to one of his younger sister's houses for dinner. During the visit to them, Terry and Charlie called Angela, who was about an hour's drive away, and she asked to meet Charlie the next day, and he says, "Sorry, I've got plans. Maybe next time. Good talking to you again, Angie." Charlie was wanting to go home the next day. The hurricane had moved and bypassed their home. "So let's go back," he told Terry on the Sunday. He changed his mind suddenly on the Monday and told Michelle they would stay yet another day. Terry wasn't happy, but oh well.
It's quite hard to draw conclusions about their relationship based on what you're saying now. What is this account from? Is this entirely from her diaries? Is it the way that Carl is saying what happened? Where is this coming from?
This is coming from her diaries, friends.
It's an amalgamation of different information to explain what's happening.
Yeah, okay. This is what the police put together afterwards.
Because it is hard to draw conclusions, like I said, on the relationship up until then. You don't know how willing, complicit, or up for it that Terry was, that stuff that even Carl had suggested, etc. Because at this point, you're in the early 2000s, aren't you?
Yeah, Terry had spoken to her sister by the phone. She wasn't happy that he wanted to stay another night, but what Charlie seemed to want, Charlie seemed to get.
At this point, they're pushing 50 as well.
Yeah. So Michelle was very close with her mother. They usually chatted daily on the phone. And she had a lot of friends, and she was always talking to friends. And she'd invited one particular friend to come over for dinner to catch up with Charlie and Terry. The friend knew them and liked them. But on the Monday evening, 13th of September, Michelle called her friend and said, "Actually, don't come over. These two have been drinking and arguing, so it's not a good atmosphere." A bit like Christmas is at a lot of people's houses, really, isn't it? Even though it's September. Michelle didn't speak to her mother the next day. Very unusual. But having visitors, her mother didn't think an awful lot of it. But by the evening of the 15th, on the Wednesday, and her mother still couldn't get hold of her, she managed to get one of Michelle's many other friends on the phone and asked her to swing by Michelle's house just to check. This friend had a key, she knew. The friend is on the mobile with Michelle's mother when she gets to the house, and she tells her that Charlie and Terry's car is still in the driveway. They were supposed to have gone home on the Tuesday. This friend can't get any answer at the door, and it's locked, and the key she had wasn't working. It's possible it was locked from the inside. It's never clarified. So she decides to go to the garage to see if she can get in that way. Yeah?
This is Terry's mum.
No, this is Terry's friend. She's on the phone talking to Terry's mum the whole time she's doing this. The door to the garage had a large glass panel, and this friend was able to make out some of the insides of the garage, and what she saw made no sense, and the door was unlocked and she entered. What she'd seen were legs suspended in midair. What she finds is Charlie, dressed in a white polo shirt and blue shorts, hanging from the rafters of the garage, suspended by his neck and very, very dead. A 6-foot metal stepladder stood within reach of his feet. The call to the police is logged at 7:34 p.m. They go in and find slumped in a sitting position on the far end of a couch and wearing only a yellow T-shirt was Terry. She had been stabbed in the chest several times. In the master bedroom, the body of Michelle lay on the bed. She had been stabbed once in the chest and decapitated, her head placed next to her body. Her left leg was detached at the hip. Her breasts and heart had been removed and left beside her body on the bed. Two blood-stained kitchen knives were nearby. Scattered on the floor, chopped up, were assorted knickers and bras, all from Victoria's Secret. And that is why, in a lot of places, this case is called the Victoria's Secret Murder, but it's much darker than that. Charlie told co-workers about his wife's niece and how they were off to visit her and shelter from the hurricane. He had told them she was called Victoria. Police also find catalogues from the firm at Charlie and Terry's house. All of them were addressed to him.
By the firm, you mean Victoria's Secret?
Yeah. So it's not good advertising for these guys at this point, is it?
Unless some companies will kind of seed information so it gets put in the mainstream media. Like, yes. Oh, my toddler had my phone and ordered 307 cheeseburgers and it got went through, blah, blah, blah. That's just a way for like Deliveroo to get put on.
Yeah.
In like mainstream media. This ain't the kind of vibe you want, is it?
No, not at all. No, not at all.
People were dismembered, killed, sort of surrounded by a satanic ritual of Victoria's Secret stuff with a bloke that's just hung himself that's done it. That's really, that's like, yeah, no, can you not use her name, please, kind of thing.
Michelle led a nice life. She's the kind of target market for Victoria's Secret. Expensive, nice underwear. You know, matching sets that most ladies can't always afford. And he chopped all the bloody things up as well. Charlie's house. They find in the bedroom that he shared with Terry an anatomy poster, like a medical one, of a woman attached to the back of the bedroom door. Now, the police officers that found it were slightly astonished because they'd never seen an anatomy poster quite like that, that it was obviously female, but the woman's hair was up in a bun at the back of the head. It's quite a...
I can see this image now. As if you didn't know it was a female based on, like, the pelvis, like, the uterus, the breast tissue. Let's put hair on it so you can really, like, gender this or sex this anatomy drawing thing.
It was odd. And it was attached to the back of the bedroom door. So every time Terry shut the bedroom door, she would have seen this.
Unless he's training to be a physio, I don't see the point.
No. So Charlie also didn't clear his history or browser. Authorities found internet searches like dead women autopsies, disembowelment and... dark fantasies. Angela, she knows all of this has happened. She finally fessed up to Michelle's family and the police about what Charlie had done over 30 years earlier. Authorities go digging in the archives back to 1973. The killings were classified as ritualistic and they found matches, one in Big Pine Key and one in Miami-Dade County, plus 26 others with similar characteristics were found in the FBI database. They also put a plea out Europe-wide, because Charlie had been known to travel on occasions as well overseas, to see if they had any other cases that could match where Charlie had been, you know, that were unsolved, but they eventually were all dismissed. In July 1989, just months after Charlie and Terry moved to Big Pine Key, the body of Sherry Perisho was found floating face down under a bridge, 1,000 feet from Terry and Charlie's home. The fishermen were out there just doing their fishing stuff and they pulled in what they thought was a mannequin or a pile of rags, and of course it wasn't. Sherry was 38. She lived in a small boat and had been seen riding her bike earlier that day. They estimated that she'd been in the water no longer than 12 hours. And the autopsy found that her throat had been slit with what they described as surgical incision. And her heart had also been removed. In November 1995, along a Miami-Dade County highway that Charlie would have used to get in and out of the Keys, the mutilated body of Darlene Toler, a 35-year-old sex worker, was discovered in a plastic bag. The head and heart were missing. Charlie kept mileage records of his travels, which showed an entry for 100 miles on the day of her murder, roughly the driving distance between Big Pine Key and the area of Miami where Darlene's body was found. The other two, well, there's a couple of others that are convinced that Charlie was responsible for.
Why do you keep driving records? Well, as in how far he'd driven?
How many miles he did. My father used to do that. every single
if someone does that, they're a serial killer. I know he's killed people now, so we know that already, but people do that, that's weird. You don't do that. What the fuck?
Cars didn't have trip monitors when I was a kid. It wasn't a thing.
And he kept a
mileage log
tracking in between services or whatever. But okay, yeah, but that would have been what, 90s at that point,
the time this done would, it. Yeah,
I know now it's in the 2000s, but when that might have happened, yep, when she was found in the 90s, like,
but I have to agree with you, it's unusual for that time to do it. Carol Sullivan, aged 12. She was abducted from a school bus stop in Volusia County on September the 20th, 1978. Her skull was found in a bucket, leading authorities to presume she was murdered and decapitated. Well, she didn't take her own head off, did she? Charlie was 20 years old and lived in the same county at the time, but he couldn't be tied to the crime in any other way. So she was 12, so that's pedophilia right there, isn't it? If he's definitely up for her. Lisa Saunders, aged 20. She had been dragged from her car in Big Pine Keys in December of 1988. She was beaten and then stabbed. A heart was missing when she was found. They couldn't tell if it was animal activity or if her heart had been removed by the murderer. I'm guessing her body must have started to decompose and they couldn't say if there was knife wounds or anything around some of it. Going back to if Terry knew. Well, she confided in a relative that on the night that Sherry had gone missing in 1989, Charlie had come home covered in blood.
When you say new, do you mean about the murder that he did when he was younger or these ones that are now surfacing?
These ones. Whether she knew Charlie was off, Charlie was not quite right, yeah? He'd come home covered in blood and he claimed it was from filleting fish, but she wasn't convinced.
Did he even smell of fish? That's what I mean.
Yeah. Plus, Charlie matched the police e-fit that they put out. Police concluded that Charlie was the murderer in Sherry's case and closed the file as solved on the 6th of May, 2006. So 2 years after the murder of his wife and niece by marriage. There was a 48 hours episode where they tried to get more information about Charlie and see if they could tie any other cases in. So now he's officially a serial killer. And unfortunately, many other families without any answers. Police try and unlock Charlie's old medical records from when he was locked up and he killed his mother. And they can't. They're sealed as he was a minor at the time of the offence. Very interestingly, his father, as Charlie's heir, as it were, refuses to allow them to be unsealed. No one knows why. Why the police can't get them unlocked is not revealed. He's deceased, so I would have thought it shouldn't have been a big issue, but they can't. When this all happened, his father was in his 70s, so maybe when he passes, but would the rights to keep them sealed go to his sisters? I don't know. Michelle's family are still angry, very angry with Charlie's family, and angry with the system. 8 years after Michelle was killed, they were trying to get a law passed that would allow any old homicide records of juveniles to be unlocked. It was to be called Michelle's Law, but I can't find out if it ever got through. And they appeared on an episode of Dr. Phil, I think it was, to talk about all of that. Angela had either been married or been in this relationship, like I said, and Charlie had stayed friends with this ex-brother-in-law, as we'll call him. When they separated, this chap is on record saying that he asked if Charlie and Terry were going to have children. He asked Terry. And Terry replied, considering everything, I don't think it's a good idea. So that would imply that Terry knew
something was wrong. But then why would she marry him in the first place? If you don't want to marry someone and have kids based on whatever reason, you don't obviously need to have kids. If that's enough for her to not want to have kids, then why marry him in the first place? When that's like a clear cause for concern?
Apparently they had an amazing relationship. There's lots of people that have talked about them afterwards and said that if their husband or wife loved them the way Charlie...
They loved each other.
Yeah.
So then I guess him saying that he wants to do these things and her just going along with it might not be as black and white as it's portrayed by the police in the first place.
Yeah.
Because that's what I'm wondering. I'm trying to sort of piece it together in my head.
It could have been this Madonna, you know, the Madonna concept that some men have with their wives, that they wouldn't dream of treating them. So this is why maybe he's killed 26, 27, 28.
Oh, as in they kind of lash out for annoyances that would have on their wife onto other people.
Yes.
So he comes home, dinner isn't made, he goes out, kills someone.
Yes.
Or fillets a fish.
Yeah, exactly. So there's many inconsistencies in the reporting on this.
I hadn't heard what the Madonna thing was, by the way. You kind of struggled to form a sentence there, and I didn't really get it until...
I was thinking Elvis Presley in my head.
I pieced out, I don't know what the fuck you were thinking, but I managed to piece it together.
Yeah, Elvis Presley, the reason apparently his marriage to Priscilla fell apart was after she had the baby, he considered her to be a perfect woman, and he didn't want to sleep with her anymore, and she felt...
I very weirdly hear about that occasionally.
Yeah, it's the Madonna complex. Men put their wives on like a
pedestal.
A pedestal, but it's their mental pedestal. It's not necessarily that they spoil them rotten. So what it got me, I guess there's so many ways you can ask a question, answer a question. Memories fade or they play tricks. People embellish stories. This is why it was really, really hard getting an actual clear storyline on this one. And it got me thinking, why did he kill himself after killing Michelle and Terry? And we don't actually know who was killed first. Not sure they could tell, but probably Terry for that exact reason we've just discussed. Killing Michelle, it was a culmination of his fixation, wasn't it? It was probably that he'd been obsessed with Michelle for quite a while, especially that creepy nickname. And it was the apex of his crimes. Where could he go after killing her? He'd killed his wife. He killed his mother and he killed a niece by marriage. Short of killing his sisters, not sure where he would have gone. And thinking about that, I wonder if that's why Angela won't talk now. Also, the fact that his wife was older than his mother was when he killed her. So Terry was 46 and I think Ilse was 40 when she was killed. I obviously feel sorry for poor Michelle's family, but also for Charlie's younger sisters. A secret like that blew their whole lives apart. All they thought they knew was a lie. Angela, too, to a degree, because she was probably and is probably consumed with guilt. And if she had been more forceful about being an open and honest, these crimes may not have happened. But equally, Charlie could have gone after her and her child. So I get why she stayed quiet. And Dad, well, cultural maybe, age, stoic silence. And again, probably guilt too.
No, man's a twat. I don't care.
Well, what's the point in talking about it? I would think they would think. I'm playing devil's advocate here. You can't change the outcome and they would absolutely get dragged in the press now, and especially now with social media. So if they did talk about it, so they're staying silent and they refuse all requests for interviews. But I do think they ought to unseal those bloody medical records.
I've actually got written down, Dad's deranged too. His son killed his wife and his unborn child, and yes, then they uprooted the entire family repeatedly to bring him closer to Charlie, or Carl, whatever he wants to be called. I don't know, that's what I've got him written down here. So then that made his sister, that changed the trajectory of his sister's life entirely. Yes. He was also a victim, not only a victim of almost getting shot, whatever sort of version of events you want to believe.
Yep.
She's a victim because she lost her mother as well, and her whole family's been destroyed.
Yes.
And then now suddenly it's like, oh, your brother did this. He's come back now, that's normal. You have to be completely normal or not to be permanently scarred or suffering PTSD from this event, by the way. Yep. I just don't get it. And then when it does happen again, the dad goes, yeah, I'm not. We're going to release anything that might kind of explain this or potentially have a learning experience so you can sort of study the events of a serial killer as a child. No, I'm not going to do that. Chuck him in the volcano along with Carl. Fuck the dad.
I'm also, now you've said that, I've got in my head forming, I'm wondering if this is a golden child type scenario. And the fact
I don't understand
his son.
It. I don't understand it. It might be some weird cultural thing from him being from him being German descent and his son, and I'm thinking, did his son do it because he pissed off at his dad for shooting the dog and then doesn't like the fact that he can't fit in properly because he's not American, he's German at this point because both his parents are German. Sure, he might have been born in the US, but he's still German. He's all of his culture is German. He probably speaks with an accent slightly because he was taught English by his parents to a certain degree. So he won't fit in. So maybe that's why he lashed out, but to just not allow anything, and they say golden child, weird thing, I don't get it.
No, and going back to
his dad's deranged.
What you've just said there, talking about, you know, his father and this World War II generational thing, it is the fact that Charlie asked his father's permission to cry when he saw him in the hospital.
Because that might have been their relationship. His dad could have been abusive. Because, yeah. I mean, by could have, that I'm using that word kind of lightly because he shot his dog. That's pretty abusive. So you don't know what it would be where he kind of has to ask these things. And that's why there's this weird transient event of him shooting someone. I don't understand it. And I really don't get his dad. What was his upbringing during this? It wasn't particularly normal. based on the events, then definitely his sister's wasn't being dragged about having to be around Charlie all the time.
But also the fact that the two younger ones were never told the truth, and he ups and leaves with his second wife and leaves the 16-year-old back in Florida and ships, I don't know whose parents it was, over from Germany.
Grandparents, yeah.
To look after him. That's...
Again, I don't feel like the dad's... I feel like your dad's almost a perpetrator at this point. I blame his dad for a lot of shit. I know we're speculating, there's random podcasts, but I don't like the dad.
Ultimately, there's only one person to blame, and that's Charlie, and I think he was just not wired right, but the whole thing is a shit show, isn't it? It's an absolute...
But to be linked with 26 potential murders, doesn't that put him quite high up the list?
Yeah, but that's all gone deathly quiet. I'm assuming they've got no...
They probably can't prove it. Sure, it's young women that might fit the same description that are missing their heart, and that seems to be his thing.
Yeah,
I don't get it.
Going back to what you just said there, yes, it would put him very, very high on a serial killer list.
It seems to be people that... I wasn't going to say scored highest, but that's not the word. Obviously, it's not a point system. But the most prolific serial killers tend to be in the medical field, don't they? Because it's easier for them to access people.
Mm-hmm.
Or you get a trucker because they're never in the same place again and they can kill people on the way.
Yes. It's the ease of being able to do it.
Yeah, the access to people.
Yeah, but Charlie didn't have that. And it's why he did this. I really would like to see what was it. Oh, it's not a case of I want to see what's in the records. I would like somebody who is far more qualified, that's funny, somebody who's actually qualified to go read those notes and actually come to some sort of a conclusion what was going on in his head when he killed his mother. It's the fact is that baby that his mother was carrying and she was 8 months pregnant, it was another boy. So he...
Yeah, it could be tied in thinking I might lose my golden child thing on my dad, even though it's not. It's weird.
And finally, the victims who should not be forgotten. Ilse Brandt, aged 40. Terry Brandt, aged 46. Michelle Jones, aged 37. And Sherry Parisho, aged 38.
So that's the end of the podcast. Thank you very much for listening. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Murder Me Monday Podcast. Email us at murdermemondaypodcast@gmail.com. You can support us on Patreon. It's in the description, show note, all that good stuff below. And we'll see you next time. Peace.
Bye.